I'll start off by telling you the story of the return journey, just briefly, and then just unpacking some of the themes and the motifs that come up in the story, and relate them to the Buddhist teachings, obviously. But as you're listening to me, also think back on your meditation and your, you know, relating it a bit to your own lives as well, because that's the whole point of these stories. You know, how does that relate to me? How does that relate to your life? So maybe see if you can listen to me in that vein. So I'll start off by briefly retelling the story. It's quite an archetypal story in a way. So in the story, a young man leaves his father and he runs far away to live in a different country. And it says in the story, interestingly, and we'll come back to that, for 10, 20 or even 50 years. So timings are quite vague in the story, and there might be a meaning in that. So for a long time, he runs far away. Doesn't say why he's run away so far from home. So then the older he gets, the more needy and destitute he becomes. And he's kind of roaming about. And as he's roaming about, he unexpectedly, without knowing it, approaches his native country. And in his search for work, food and clothing, he comes upon the city where his father has settled. Now, he doesn't know that his father has settled there. So all of this is by coincidence, and he doesn't really know it. But he just sort of stumbles upon the city where his father has settled. His father, in the meantime, has been searching for him in vain, and he's never forgotten him. And despite being quite rich and successful, his father hasn't been happy. He's been longing to be reunited with his son, and especially as he was getting older, he was thinking of his death approaching, and really wanting to share and give his riches to his child. So the son unexpectedly arrives at his father's house and is looking for work. But on seeing all that wealth and beauty and his father sitting there, he just runs away and thinks, oh my goodness, this isn't for me. And, you know, I need to go and find a poorer village. He doesn't feel worthy of finding work in such a rich place. But as he comes to the house, his father recognizes him and he excitedly sends his servants to run after the son and says, get him back here, call him back. But the son misunderstands. So when they run after him, they think that they're after him, they're going to arrest him, they're going to throw him in jail for something that he's meant to have done. So he is frightened, he runs away, and when they grab hold of him, he faints. He sort of falls down in a faint. So then his father realizes that his son is so estranged from him that he really, he has to be patient. He's got to try to bring him closer to him a little bit more gradually, sort of employing what's called in Buddhism skillful means. So in a way, sort of tricking him, doing things gradually, you know, because he's not ready for just being reunited with him. So he asks his servants to hire him as a labourer. And so the job he gives him is to shift this huge heap of dirt. And the son very happily accepts this. You know, yeah, that's the kind of work that he's been doing all along. And after working like this for years, so he lives in a hovel, he shifts this huge heap of dirt, his father kind of dresses himself in some rough clothes and sort of joins him, on the heap of dirt, and he says to him, look, you've been working here really hard for years, been very impressed by your hard and diligent work. I want to give you a promotion, you know. I give you some lodging near my mansion, and he gives him sort of a more responsible job of looking after his wealth, basically. And at that point, the son accepts that. So he accepts more and more responsibility, becomes responsible for handling the treasures and the possessions of his father gradually, until he feels quite comfortable going in and out of his father's mansion and doesn't any more longer feel intimidated. But he still lives in a straw hovel nearby. So he still lives very, very poorly, but he's no longer intimidated. And the old man says to him that you're like a son to me and that he would like to share his wealth with him. And his son sort of grows in self-esteem and confidence, and eventually comes to regret his former life, thinking, why did I live like that? I didn't need to do that. And then finally, on his deathbed, The father reveals to him that he is indeed his son and he's his father. And that actually, you know, he says, you're going to inherit my riches, you're my son. And at that point, the son is overjoyed, can't believe. And he says, so all this, without any mind or effort on my part, these treasures have come of themselves to me. So that is the story. And I don't know what whether some of you have had a Christian upbringing and might sort of feel a little bit like almost like they recognize the story, because there is a similar story in a Christian in the Bible called the prodigal son, where also a son sort of, you know, gets very estranged from his father, comes back, gets forgiven. But there are some so there's some similarities of the Christian story of the prodigal son in the plot of a wayward son getting lost and later finding the way back to their father. But there's also a crucial difference between the two stories, because in the Christian story, the son was, I think it was, sent away from his home because of having behaved badly, broken the rules, not conformed. And then he's later forgiven for this. So behind that is kind of this thinking of human beings as originally sinful and guilty and having to be forgiven. While in the Buddhist myth, it's more the son gets lost. You don't even find out why he's wandered away. It's more he's got lost and confused out of ignorance and forgetfulness rather than having done anything wrong. So the Buddhist view that is sort of lies underneath that is that we need to clear away this dirt, you know, like the heap of dirt of ignorance and illusion, which hides our true jewel-like nature. So it's a very, very different kind of belief of what human beings are. So the Buddhist myth is that we need to clear away the dirt and then a jewel will be revealed. And the human predicament is our sort of, that we have this distorted way of looking at reality through a kind of murky lens, just like that son couldn't really see that the father wished him well, you know, that he wanted to get him back to the house in order to be reunited with him. He thought he was persecuting him and he was going to throw him in prison. So it really shows like his distorted view and irrational fears and misunderstandings arising from that. And so in Buddhism very much it's believed that that is our problem as human beings, that we see things in a distorted way. We don't see them clearly as they really are. But not that we're poor sinners, like in Christianity, very different. So in the White Lotus Sutra, the story illustrates what's called the Bodhisattva path. So a Bodhisattva is an enlightened being. So it's the path of compassion. So the White Lotus Sutra in itself says that the path of compassion and of the Bodhisattva is higher and richer than that of the Arahant, of somebody who only aims for individual liberation and enlightenment for himself only. And I think Ratnaprabha was talking about that in his talk a few weeks ago. That's the Mahayana view, that the highest path is the Bodhisattva path of compassion. So the Buddha is saying to his most advanced disciples and followers with this story that the Arahant path was only kind of a step on the way, skillful means from his point of view, a more understandable and attainable goal for the level of understanding of the people the Buddha was teaching earlier in his life. So, you know, when the son sort of works for years and years clearing away the heap of dirt, what you could see that as is he's clearing away sort of his negative emotions, his delusions, his wrong view of seeing things. And only when he's done that, when he's sort of cleared away this individual heap of dirt of the sort of messed up emotions in a way, can he see a little bit more clearly and can he be receptive to the riches that he's being offered. So the story is also related to that of the hidden jewel. So you might remember that before we started talking about the Mahayana teachings, we had as a theme here briefly the story of the hidden jewel, where a drunk man, his friend, sewed a jewel into his garment And the friend, a little bit similar to this young man here, lived sort of for years in poverty and couldn't make ends meet and kept looking for sort of menial work. And then after years, his friend gets reunited with him and says to him, "But what are you doing? You've had this jewel all along, didn't you realise?" You know, and he didn't realise. Now, in that story of the hidden jewel, the difference between that story and this one of the return journey is that the friend is reunited with, you know, the friends are reunited, and in fact his friend quite roughly and abruptly says to him, "For goodness sake, don't be so stupid, here is the jewel," you know. And the implication is that his friend is just, you know, then realizes and can live in a different way. While in the story of the return journey, it needs a very gradual approach, because this young man is just too far away from even knowing that there's any jewel anywhere inside him or anything that worthy inside him. He's just too scared, so he needs to be sort of led to it sort of step by step and gradually. So the two stories show sort of the difference between abrupt method of showing somebody, you know, the truth or how things really are, and showing them gradually. So I'll just go through, I want to mainly go through some of the motifs in the story in more detail. So this section of my talk is really based on this. I don't know if it's actually still in print. I think that maybe it's going to come back into print. But there's this book by Sangharakshita, which is a commentary on the White Lotus Sutra, which is called The Drama of Cosmic Enlightenment. And it's quite something. It's really very interesting. So if any of you ever think of reading the White Lotus Sutra, this is a good companion book to have to just sort of unpack a little bit the meaning of these stories. So I'm going to try and relate these themes also to my own experience a bit on the spiritual path so far. And the other thing I just want to say, I mean, it's very the story is about a father and a son. But it could equally be, I think, about a mother and a daughter or a child and a parent, you know. So being a woman, I think I will sort of make that point as well and not just refer to, think about it as parent and child of any gender, actually. Because I think the point of the story is that somebody who's got very lost and confused and is quite immature in their spiritual development, being shown gradually the way by somebody who's more mature and more developed, like a parent figure or a teacher figure. And so whether that's male or female, doesn't really that much come into it. So let's start with the first motif is really the separation of the son from the father, or the daughter from the mother, the child from the parent. So what might that symbolise? And what Sangharakshita talks about in his commentary is an alienation. There's often an alienation of our physical and psychological state from our spiritual longings and ideals. So if you think, I mean, Sangharakshita, a bit controversially now, talks about it in terms of lower and higher development or evolution. But some of you might have come across this, the sociological model of Maslow's pyramid, if any of you come across. But, you know, if you think about it, before you can sort of develop spiritually or even emotionally, your basic physical needs of sort of food, shelter, clothing, you know, have to be taken care of first. If you're so poor, so deprived that you don't have your physical needs met, you're not going to be receptive to anything higher than that, you know, any more subtle needs than that. So there is a kind of hierarchy in that way, in that first of all you need to look after the basic needs of somebody before they can be receptive to the higher needs. And in a way the story illustrates that, you know, the son is so, you know, can't recognise anything about this mansion and is in fact frightened of it at first and needs to sort of spend years sort of clearing away this heap of dirt and just building up some self-esteem in a way. And some belief in themselves that they can work hard and that they've deserved something before they can be receptive to anything else. So another way of thinking about it is also that It's only when we have our physical and emotional well-being looked after and we're quite stable and integrated, I suppose, physically and emotionally, that we can look at life and ask, well, what can I contribute? What can I give to this situation? Rather than always coming from an attitude of lack, of what do I need, you know, needing something, being very needy. We need to sort of develop as individuals enough first by having our physical and emotional needs met before we can be in that happier state where we can feel we can contribute something and we don't just feel poor and lacking in confidence or lacking in anything to offer and afraid of others in the world. So then following on from that, there is the parents' material wealth. So what does that symbolize? It might be a bit confusing to find that in a Buddhist story. Well, it symbolizes kind of the father's or the parents' spiritual treasures, really. So his great wealth sort of shows that he's living from that place of growth and development where he wants to offer something. He wants to find his son. He wants to offer some of his riches and some of what he's learned rather than simply satisfying his basic needs. So he's coming from a much wider, higher perspective, the father. And then the father or the parent never forgets his child. He always thinks of him, longs for a reunion. So you can look at that as the parent sort of seeing the child suffering from this wider perspective and his potential to overcome it. And although the son or the child from a small perspective is unaware of all of this and full of fear in relation to life, is kind of has this tunnel vision, the parent can see the potential and they can try and help them reach it. So in a way we can think of the father and son or the parent and child as two, also we could think of them as two unintegrated aspects of the same person, of us maybe, you know. Sometimes we have these aspects feeling very low in confidence and then we might be very confident in another area of our lives. And in a way, we need to bring those parts of ourselves closer together. And that can sometimes take quite some time and quite some hard work to kind of heal and make it possible for that person to live life to their full potential and to develop our minds to our full potential. One example from philosophy, I suppose, would be there is, some of you might have come across, there's Plato's parable of the cave. Have any of you come across that? So it's basically a parable where some people are living inside a cave and quite a dark cave, a little bit of light coming in from the top, and can only see shadows on the walls, people moving about, sort of outside a cave up there. And they think that the shadows are all there is, you know, that the cave where they live, the quite claustrophobic cave, is all there is, and the shadows are actually the only other beings there are. And they can't see the whole wider, bigger world outside. So it's a little bit like that, the father and the son. So the people from outside the cave need to find a way of showing the people in the cave, actually there's much more. The people in the cave themselves don't have that vision. You know, they can only see where they are. They're sort of trapped in their small state of mind. So then there's the child inadvertently wandering back to the father's or the parent's home. And he's sort of stumbling about in his search and distress and confusion. And then sort of quite unconsciously comes upon someone or something trustworthy. This, I mean, you might recognize that from your lives, how that sometimes happens. You feel quite lost, but you come across something or you come across someone offering you something. Somebody who can help us, something that can help us, although we might not have recognized it until, or might not recognize it until much later, just like the son in the story. So I suppose one example from my own life is I sort of randomly booked myself, this was now about 18 years ago, I randomly booked myself onto this meditation course at the North London Buddhist Centre. At the time, I was feeling incredibly stressed at the time. I was quite messed up psychologically as well. And I really, all I could think of was I need something to calm me down. And it was quite random that I just came across this course. And it happened, it was this Buddhist movement. And then I really enjoyed the course and it really helped me. And a little bit later, I went on a retreat at Christmas and then started going to the East London Buddhist Centre. So through just doing this random meditation course, I was sort of led step by step to something that really made a massive difference to my life, actually, in retrospect. I misunderstood a lot of the things that were being taught. I criticised a lot of it. But something kept me hooked and something kept me going. And there was just this vague sense that there's something here, you know, there's something here that can help me. So at first, sometimes we're quite afraid and maybe rejecting and may feel hostile to some aspects of spiritual practice because we don't want to change really, or we're afraid of real change, of something that would make a real difference, real deep transformation. But letting go of that fear is necessary in order to move forward. So I'm incredibly grateful, especially to some of my teachers at that time, because I must have been quite a pain in these classes. You know, I remember the bodhisattvas, the beings made of light. You know, I was making a lot of fun of them. I just thought it was some new age rubbish. You know, it was so idealized. And I mean, I must have been, but people were so patiently explaining to me, no, you're not getting this quite right, you know. And then I remember Maitreya Bandhu introducing me to this figure, Padmasambhava, who is not just a being made of light, but he was actually also a historical figure, and he's got a little frown rather than a smile. And I could relate to that figure, you know, and he sort of could see that, you know, that's probably the figure, sort of a stepping stone. You know? And I thought, I'm really grateful to him for having done that, you know, and not sort of just dismissing me, you know. So yes, I did eventually realise I had quite a large heap of dirt to clear away, just like that son in the story, in terms of very wrong views and sort of negative emotions that I had, lots of rage and all sorts of things. So interestingly, in his commentary, Sangharakshita likens the clearing away of the heap of dirt to psychoanalysis. I was quite amazed by that. I was just talking in the tea break to Mitrananda and saying that I am actually a child psychotherapist, you know. And another thing I often got quite angry about when I first came across the movement was in a lot of his writings, Sangharakshita writes very critically of any kind of therapy and especially of psychoanalysis. But actually, this is an exception, you know. Here he was actually talking about it in quite positive terms. And sort of in terms of that we sometimes have to recognise that it may well be necessary if you're in quite serious distress or mental confusion that you might need some therapy. You might need to do something on that level, you know, on that emotional level, again, before you can become receptive to maybe the Buddhist teachings, the spiritual teachings. You have to, first of all, be a little bit more in a balanced and positive mental state. And that was definitely my experience. I had to become much less angry and depressed before I could be receptive to the more positive teachings and could take on board and could even access, in a way, the more positive, brighter emotions, really. And also, before I could realise, and again, it's a bit like in the story, isn't it? Before I could realise that I was contributing a lot to my own unhappiness, you know? Like this son, he's just confused, he's living in poverty, he doesn't need to. It's because of his limited view, and that was the case with me, definitely. So then there's this theme of freely going in and out of the father's mansion, but still living in a straw hovel, which is quite interesting. So the son, the child gradually sort of grows in confidence. He can now maybe access and understand that there's a higher perspective from which to look at life, but maybe still clinging to Sometimes I find that too. We're still, even though you can recognize something intellectually, you're still clinging to your own old habitual ways of going about life. You don't really want to change. So I found that very much in my own spiritual, on my own spiritual path. It's can relate it directly to the journey. So ever since my ordination, which was now 7 years ago, I've only very slowly and cautiously moved away from it. I used to be quite a workaholic, really work far too much, looking a lot also for love and status, because of my work, because of my state, you know, wanting appreciation for that. So I've only worked relatively slowly towards a bit more expansive letting go of these expectations and allowing myself to follow a bit of a deeper thread, regardless of what others think of that and of me. I didn't have any children or conventional family. All of those steps of not going down that route and doing something different were quite difficult and quite gradual for me too. But gradually I did find that deep friendships did fulfill quite a lot of my emotional needs, deep friendships in the Sangha. I left full-time work. I valued time and energy more than money and status gradually. And now I'm sort of planning to leave the city and my familiar, secure friendships and professional connections here in the city. And even now that I've decided to do that and I really want to do it and I'm excited about it, I'm also really still anxious about it. And I have my moments when I think, I'm not so sure about that. But I've lived here so long, you know, I should just stay here. It's safe. It feels quite unsafe sometimes to really, really change. But in the meantime, I think I've had enough experiences of changing and of doing something that feels a bit uncomfortable out of my comfort zone and it working out well that I can sort of live with those flashes of anxiety and still sort of go ahead. So then there's the theme of the return journey, which in a way stands again for the overcoming of alienation and maybe integration of our energies. So we might realize that sort of each of us has the potential to enlightenment, to become like the Buddha. And if we fully open up to that possibility and place it at the center of our lives and hearts, it may take a long time for this to ripen and develop, but eventually, if we allow it room to grow, like drops of water gradually filling a water jar is quite a lovely traditional Buddhist metaphor for this often very slow process, and it requires patience and persistence. You know, we will move forward in our spiritual lives. And return also, I mean, I took return journey to mean that it's because an aspect of remembering maybe something genuinely happy in your childhood quite often, and taking that as a guide may well be helpful. So there is actually an example in the Buddha's own life story, which many of you will be familiar with, where the Buddha had been searching for a way out of suffering for quite some time. He'd sort of done all sorts of very harsh things to his body, hardly eating at all, and nothing had kind of helped. And what helped him forward in the end was just remembering a moment when, as a child, he'd sat under a rose apple tree, and I think his father and servants were ploughing the field in front of them, and there was nothing particularly spectacular happening. It's just an afternoon, he was sitting under a tree, he was watching them ploughing the field, and it was beautiful, and he was just feeling relaxed. And he just remembered that moment and thought, oh, maybe that's a clue as to what I should be doing. And that's what led him to then sit under the Bodhi tree, you know, and meditate just until he'd gained enlightenment, rather than, you know, he was eating things again. He thought, there's no point actually sort of almost killing my body. It's just sort of draining me of energy. What I need to do is this. So there might be some moment that we remember that helps us forward in our quest. And again, in my case, I suppose at the moment what I've got in my mind a lot is this moving out of the city. Where I'm moving to, I don't really have an existing connection to, particularly in Cornwall, but I do have a connection to nature in general, and that comes from my grandmother. And I do remember spending weekends with her, and just, I didn't realise as a child how significant she was for me, but just her living in this, literally in a house in the forest, and finding even a village too big, and really just loving her garden and connecting with animals and plants and knowing where the wild bushes were in the forest. All of that, it's become much more significant to me now as an adult, and I kind of almost want to emulate her. So that's quite interesting to me, that there is a kind of return in that way. And then I don't know if any of you might have had the experience of only a year later in life recognising the significance of certain people, certain things, certain decisions, and how things connect up in your life. You didn't really know they connected up. They might have seemed quite random at the time, but then something somehow sometimes connects up in a really mysterious way. I had that with when I became a therapist, actually. When I started my therapy training, I was a teacher at first and then I trained as a therapist. And when I told an old friend of mine in Germany that that's what I was going to do, I was going to become a child psychotherapist, she said, "Oh, yeah, that doesn't surprise me." She said, "You said that when you were 16. I said, "Did I?" And then she had been my best friend at the time, and she became anorexic at the time when we were teenagers, and had to actually go to an inpatient hospital. And she had child psychotherapy there, and I used to visit her in this place, and we both had sort of parents that we really would rather not have lived with, So I used to feel quite jealous of her living in this place and getting all this attention from these lovely people. And when I, just before I left the country, actually, we were having this conversation, what are we going to do when we're 30, when we're 30? And I apparently said, and I did remember it when she told me, "I'm going to be a child psychotherapist." And there I was, actually doing that training pretty much at that time. So that's quite where these things come from sometimes. And then finally, it is time for me to stop. So the vagueness about time, it says that this child had wandered off for 10, 20 or even 50 years, which is a bit puzzling. But it's in the context of this wider recurring main teaching of the White Lotus Sutra, really, which indicates sort of the deeper meaning of the story. And this is quite a difficult teaching, but it basically what the story is pointing to here, I think, is that the story lies outside of and beyond linear time altogether. It doesn't really matter how many years he's been gone. It's not simply symbolizing a journeying back to the past, but it's encouraging us to take a kind of leap of faith right here and now in the present moment, and to kind of integrate our bodies and minds and bring them closer together, so that all of our energy is available to take us further towards enlightenment, rather than pulling us away in a kind of self-sabotaging direction. So to develop the shraddha, which is the Buddhist word for a kind of faith, but faith in terms of confidence, that we can really radically change and transform ourselves and become more and more like the Buddha. And that this can happen suddenly or gradually, it can happen quickly or slowly, it can really happen at any moment. So just like the reality of the Buddha's enlightenment is sort of always there, beyond our ordinary graspable dimensions of time and space, then also the possibility of us waking up or becoming liberated is always there at each moment, actually. And it might take us 3 lifetimes, it might take us 5 minutes, we don't know. Is the truth, and it's not really about linear time.